and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and my irreplaceable co-host, Annie Reese, is out this week. But we have for you today an interview that we did around our New Orleans trip with one Dr. Howard Conyers. We didn't actually get to meet up with Howard while we were in New Orleans, but we caught up with him on the phone afterward. And, okay, Howard, his day job is rocket scientist. He is an engineer with NASA at the John C. Stennis Space Center. He tests rocket engines. He's also a barbecue pitmaster, which is where, you know, the part where we interviewed him for a food show comes in. He grew up in South Carolina with whole hog barbecue, which we've talked a little bit about on the show before back in our Asheville episodes. So, yeah, Howard bends his skills and talents in engineering to barbecue, to designing and educating with barbecue rigs. He once famously designed and implemented a whole cow barbecue, which is a feat. There's video. It's incredible. Yeah, he's also the host of a PBS video show called Nourish, which in their own words is a show about food, what it says about who we are, where we're from, and the ties that connect us. And yeah, it's a video series where there's two episodes a month, and they explore just the people and the culture and the science behind food, which, is a thing that we here at Savor are perhaps obviously behind. So, yeah, so Howard is based in New Orleans, and we absolutely knew that we had to interview him on our journey there. So, I'm going to let past Lauren and Annie and Howard take it away. So, yeah, I like to start these things off with a kind of official hi. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Dr. Howard Conyers, a pit master who also is known as a rocket scientist.
Like an actual rocket scientist, yes.
Like a real rocket scientist that pays the bills.
Not one of those fake rocket scientists.
No.
Many questions stemming off of that first thing. How did you come to be a rocket scientist?
I don't want to bore people because this is a food show, but nine years of education, all the way from growing up in South Carolina in public schools, went to North Carolina A&T and studied bioenvironmental engineering, and then I went to Duke University and got a PhD in mechanical engineering. So that's how I became a rocket scientist before I started working with NASA.
And you started doing the pitmaster thing because being from South Carolina, you grew up with some whole hog barbecue, yeah?
Yeah, that's growing up. That's what barbecue was, whole hog. I learned from my father when I was a young person. We didn't have a restaurant, but that's how I saw the whole hog barbecue tradition.
Could you talk a little bit about that tradition that you grew up with? Like what was a barbecue like?
A barbecue was like 4th of July, Christmas, Thanksgiving. We would slaughter a hog. We invite our family. We have like a big family gathering. We had a lot of aunts and uncles where I was from. I had nine aunts and uncles, and I had a lot of first cousins. So we have a big gathering, and that gathering we would have barbecue that was generally the meat of choice. And that's where we would cook before that dinner. The next day, we would start cooking barbecue that night. Or we'd start to slaughter the day before, but it was kind of something embedded in the community. A lot of families cook barbecue for their family gatherings. It wasn't just my family. And so we had barbecue restaurants, but a lot of us did it generally at home, use a technique that was passed down. Then we would do it at church for like homecoming celebrations or church anniversaries. And so that's kind of how that tradition came part of my life very early.
How did you get back into doing whole hog once you moved out to Louisiana?
When I first moved back to New Orleans, you get homesick. New Orleans is a great food city, and when I moved here, they said they had barbecue, and they said and a couple places had Carolina barbecue on their menu, but when I tasted it, it wasn't Carolina barbecue. They didn't do the little things. They didn't do a lot of things to make Carolina barbecue, and so that kind of motivated me. So you know what? If I'm gonna get it, I'm at least do something to show what Carolina barbecue is. I knew it was, and so they had this barbecue fundraiser hall, so it calls it it was a good cause to get behind, where they were raising money for kids with pediatric brain cancer. They cooked barbecue, and I said, you know what, that would be something I will do to try to see if I can share what I know about barbecue, Carolina barbecue.
Yeah. We talked to one of our interview subjects, whose name I'm forgetting completely right now, in a barbecue restaurant in New Orleans. So is there kind of like a resurgence of barbecue over there? Are people getting back into it?
I think
for the first time, maybe?
I think people are getting into it, and they're trying to adopt other styles of barbecue because of New Orleans has its own like grilling tradition. I don't necessarily say it was barbecue, but they call it barbecue. But I use barbecue very mean whole animals, whole hog. But mm-hmm. they use barbecue to do like smoked sausage or ribs or pork steaks. But the barbecue scene in New Orleans is going upon a resurgence because I believe this thing called Halls for the Cause, and also along with the national trend of like, I hate to say it, Texas barbecue. I'm going to say modern Texas barbecue, not old school Texas barbecue. I'm going to say modern Texas barbecue.
We're kind of giggling over here in the background because there's so much so much inter barbecue community shade that happens. And when you said Texas barbecue like that, we were like, ooh, is there is there literal beef involved?
It's no beef, but like East Texas barbecue reminds you a lot of the South. They was cooking in pits, direct heat pits, until probably the 70s, where they start this indirect smoking stuff they're known for these days.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't really, I mean, Daniel Vaughn have wrote extensively on like how the pits look in Texas at one point. But now everybody knows, associate barbecue with Aaron Franklin and the Mueller family and Tootsie, but Tootsie is the only one I think is still using the direct heat pits, but everybody else is using something that was started by the Mueller family.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, that's a whole separate avenue of question. But getting back to, so how did you get involved with Nourish?
How did I get involved with Nourish? What a great show. But they wanted to do a documentary on my story, and after I was in Denver, Colorado for this event called Slow Food Nations 2 years ago, maybe a year ago this time. No, a little over a year ago. And the producer was there and they wanted to do a documentary. And they did a documentary and they asked me, long story short, would you consider hosting a show? And I say, sure, if I get to go interview the subjects and share some of my knowledge of what I thought Southern food and culture was all about.
Yeah.
And it was digital. So like for me, that was an exciting opportunity because I saw digital as the way of the future with food shows. I mean, just media in general. And it was an opportunity to kind of explore what that was all about.
We want people to go watch the show, obviously. But could you talk a little bit about what you've learned from your guests on that show?
What I have learned from my guest on the show is just like how similar we are across the South, but also like Southern food is much more than what we think about. It's a lot deeper. And I would say one of the things I learned is like the travel of food. When you start looking at like, when I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. David Shields from the Carolina Gold Foundation, works at the University of South Carolina, just understanding the journey of like, say something as simple as corn, like a Guinea Flint corn, started in Cuba, then worked their way back to West Africa and then come back to the States, or looking at the rice, the upland rice, seeing with the Americans, seeing it in the Sea Islands of South Carolina, and then going to Trinidad after the war of 1812. Understanding those kind of nuances of travel food is very fascinating. And then when people start coming to new places, they still try to bring a part of them with them, because the food dish may look a little different, but the roots of it are the same in many cases.
Absolutely. We heard New Orleans be described as the South is north from there, as being the highest point in the Caribbean rather than the, you know, a point in the South.
I would say New Orleans is very much a different city from the rest of the South. It's It's a really a different city from the rest of the United States. It's an international city. I would say it's definitely the northernmost Caribbean city. It has a lot of people, they say that statement, but they also understand why it's the northernmost city in the United States. You have to start thinking about the Haitian Revolution and who owned the territories at a certain time before New Orleans became part of the United States. And when you understand that, you can understand why there's this, why people say it's that Caribbean connection. Because there was a lot of countries like Haiti and the people from Haiti and the sugarcane and who owned what at certain times with France having territories in the West Indies and with New Orleans, with Louisiana before the Louisiana Purchase and everything. So that's the reason this thing is a Caribbean, has that so much a Caribbean feel.
Do you feel like you're a solid part of the food community there now? And if so, I guess what's it like being part of that community?
I mean, I guess I'm a solid part in a way, but I have a unique perspective in the food community. I mean, like, yeah, I have a solid part in the say, but I can't say the food community pays my bills.
Right.
But what I could say is the knowledge base I bring to the food community and the conversations on looking at the African-American foodways in New Orleans and the contributions of West Africa on New Orleans or across the South has made me part of the food conversation. And I know sometimes people, the African-American community as well as the indigenous communities are often overlooking Southern foods. And being a Southerner, I think, I was raised in the South. I wasn't raised in the North. So I see it a little bit different because this is all I know. I don't know what it was like. I don't think of, like for me, I don't hardly ever use the word soul food because I never knew what that word was until I went to college.
Wow. Yeah. Has learning about food taught you more about science?
It has. Really, what I really like about the food thing is I think people don't realize how much science is in food. And with Nourish, I was hoping to be able to do some of that. Like we were talking about grinding grits. Nobody would think there's a friction benefit, is a factor of friction in making sugarcane, I mean, making grits or heat dissipation or viscosity. We're thinking about barbecue sauces. Or thinking about thermodynamics with using a pit versus a Cajun microwave or a cacochino or something. Like, so there's a lot of science and technology involved in the cooking process. And I have learned that when I was going to some of these restaurants and they start using the induction burners,
yeah.
I'm like, that's really fascinating to me as a person of a science. Because you need a certain type pot made from a certain material for that principle to work. So it's super fascinating.
We do have more of our interview with Howard, but first, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
So you grew up on a farm, yeah?
Correct.
And I've read that you directly credit growing up on a farm with you becoming a rocket scientist and getting into STEM in the first place. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I agree with that. I wouldn't be a rocket scientist without growing on a farm because I've seen the real applications of science and technology and engineering and mathematics on a farm. For instance, let me give you an example. We were trying to put up this barn. And as an engineer, you have like cables and you're trying to use cables to help pull something up and support things temporarily until you get it mounted securely. And we use a lot of engineering principles to help get that, I guess you would say that beam in place or the rafters and get the rafters in place. So seeing things like that early on or understanding about fertilizers, you're seeing like fertilizers, they say, oh, what is a 10-10-10? I'm like, what is that? Then I get in a science class when they're talking about nitrogen or phosphorus and potassium, but people on the farm might say it was called soda or liquid soda and or ammonia, but that's all it was. But it wasn't they didn't use the word nitrogen until I get in school. And you look at what the, I think the molecule ammonia is like NH4 or something like that, I believe. I'm going off memory. It might be NH3, so please don't shoot me. But no, you look at those compounds, you look at those chemical compounds and not really understanding what they mean, but you understand, I put it on my crops, my field gonna turn green. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you get enough water to go with it, they're gonna turn really green and then you'll have a weed problem in the field. So I mean, like, you see all those nuances, or applying like organic chicken manures to the field. Like, what was the benefit of that versus a synthetic fertilizer? I mean, I've seen so much science growing up. I was very fortunate to have a really hands-on application to understanding the sciences. I mean, a lot of people in the city, especially living in like New Orleans, they don't get the opportunity to have those hands-on exercises. But that's all I had was hands-on exercises. Mm-hmm. The book was just a kind of reinforcement. Life farm was a lab.
And you went on to kind of apply the mechanical engineering that you learned through school to make a pretty cool pit, right? Like, you designed a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, which pit you're talking about? You talking about this pit to cook a cow?
No, but talk about that. I want to know about that now. So
let me ask this question first. How many times have you heard of anybody cooking cows in this country?
A whole cow.
Whole cow.
Zero times.
Yep.
So I had this crazy idea. Well, not, it wasn't really crazy idea. All to the side. It wasn't crazy, but a lot of history books, when I started researching barbecue, and they talk about how I cook barbecue, They start having these references to cooking whole cows.
Oh my
but
goodness.
Nobody in my community cook whole cows. And I have seen, and I talked to my father about cooking cows. He's like, no, I ain't never heard of that. You're talking some craziness. But I had to show him in an article or some books, like, they cook cows too. My wife from Wisconsin, she said, you need to cook a cow. So I cooked a cow. So I had to design and engineer a pit that handled this massive, I guess, beast. So I could cook them, because once you start the cooking process with a cow, you can't really touch them. And it's not like flipping a pig.
Uh-huh.
So for four months of my life, I started designing and building a pit. When I came up with the concept of saying I'm going to cook a cow, then I knew I had to start building something to be able to handle this. And I put like about 4 months of design time off and on to go into coming up with a concept to cook this cow. And do all my bases, all my checks. Then for 2 months, we started building, and I can't take credit for building the pit. My father built the pit, but I went to South Carolina twice back to the shop to do some building and do some checkouts and verifications that we was gonna be able to flip and rotate this cow during the cooking. So that was pretty unique pit. That's where I would say rocket scientists collided with being a pit master. If people want to say where Howard Conyers cooking collide with that, I would say cooking the cow without any instrumentation, I didn't use any thermometers. And that's where the engineering overlap. That was the intersection. And I can't say that I was impressed with how it came out.
Oh my goodness. Was it delicious? Was it every bit as juicy and wonderful as a whole hog?
It was better. The history book said it like this, and this was, I'm gonna give you the opportunity to kind of see if you can imagine this. The history book says this was the best barbecue you could have. But imagine taking, for my beef lovers, not my vegans, eating all your favorite cuts of steak in one or two bites.
Annie and I just both went to a place.
Oh. Huh. All right. Yeah.
That's how I would describe it. All your cuts of beef, your favorite cuts of steak in one or two bites. Ooh.
Was that like a one and done thing? Will you ever do that? Will you ever cook a whole cow again?
I don't know. It may be it. I don't know. I mean, I have the capability now, which is always a plus.
And you but sound like a superhero. I have the capability.
I have the capability, but I don't know. Do I have the inch? I mean, like, I would do it when it makes sense, but I think it's not something you do every day.
I would agree with that.
I think it's wise. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot, but it was a very unique experience I did with it. But like, I have, at this point, I have cooked every animal raised in the American South on a farm, just domesticated. I cook a turkey, pig, lamb, goat, and a cow whole. And I have cooked in the pits above ground as well as below ground. I don't know what more I can do at that moment.
I suspect you'll think of something.
Unless somebody invite me to Dubai and say they want me to cook a whole camel or something, or Australian cook a kangaroo or something different. But stateside, I don't. But you could, the reason I say that, you laughing, but when you go into other cultures eat what they have available.
Oh, sure.
And so if I wouldn't want to cook something that they wouldn't eat, I'd rather cook something I think they will eat, but maybe put a South Carolina barbecue perspective to it.
Oh.
So they get a taste of what they're planned to get with a food that means something to them culturally.
Right, of course. Yeah. Do NASA folks like to cook?
They do. I don't know how much. I mean, everybody like to cook. Everybody like to eat. So, I mean, everybody likes to cook.
Do y'all ever have, like, office potlucks?
Yeah, sometimes I don't really cook that much at potlucks, sad to say. I'm lazy. I cook a few things I like to cook well, and I mean, I really like bacon. People don't really notice, but I really love bacon. I'm the guy who has a bunch of KitchenAid parts and equipment because I like bacon. And that was something I did with my mom. And so that's something I really enjoy doing. I just don't do it a lot. They want me to cook animals. I'm just like, y'all missing out on my bacon.
It is. It's a great physics and chemistry experiment every time you make a cake or something. That's
exactly. We couldn't run through the house when my mom was baking cakes all growing up. She's like, oh, the cake gonna fall. Cause we didn't use box mix. So we made everything from scratch. And she's like, don't run through the house, especially my grandmother. Oh, and she was a perfectionist. Every cake that she ever served had to be perfect. If it wasn't perfect, you had to go to the trash can.
Oh.
It went to the trash. I mean, and the cake would taste fantastic, but if it didn't look the par, it went straight to the trash can.
Wow. Oh, that is the opposite of what I am. I'm not the make it pretty baker, but I love doing it. I'm like, look, it's gonna taste good.
Yeah, no, she wanted to taste good, but she wanted to look good. If it don't, so I think I kind of take that approach sometimes to my hogs. Like when I cook animals or I cook any, like I want my barbecue to be almost perfect. I want it to look like it's supposed to look every time. Even if I can't control it. So I go back and study cooks that I have done in the past to kind of reflect what I did wrong. What can I do better? What was the conditions that impacted my cooking process? I think I'm maybe a little anal about the process, but hey, that's what you get when you get a rocket scientist who cooks barbecue.
Do you still, how often a year do you get to do whole hog?
So I only cooked one whole hog this year. I only cooked twice this year. I did an event in Charleston with BJ Dennis and I cooked a lamb and a hog and a pig. It wasn't even a hog. It was a little pig. It was an Osceola Island pig. We did an event with BJ Dennis in Charleston. And then I cooked the cow in New Orleans. And I haven't cooked any. That was all I cooked this year. Hmm. Go figure, right? I think Nourish got in her way of it, actually.
But, that makes sense.
We understand that one, yeah.
But no, that's all I cooked this past year. And it may be the same type thing in future years. It may be ebbs and flows. And I just kind of go as however the universe says I need to go with it.
Yeah. You kind of touched on earlier that you're involved in the slow food movement and sort of healthier, fresher ingredients, focus on that. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm a, like, even before meeting the Slow Foods, like, the mission of Slow Foods, good, clean, fair, it resonated to my whole upbringing of, like, I used to run the garden on the farm. So I was very accustomed to eating fresh and seasonal ingredients. And I think there's immense value to that, because you limit how much preservatives, how much hormones is in your food. So, like, I'm an advocate for it, and getting involved with the slow food movement is something, like, the mission, I believe, is there. The intent is there. I mean, hopefully what I hope in this whole slow food movement, or in, like, eating better quality foods, it becomes more, how I would say it, not only equitable, but I guess, like, racially. Like, when I go to the farmers markets in general or various places, like, you don't really see, I don't really get to see a whole lot of African-Americans buying stuff at the farmers market. It looks like it's very one-sided. And I know it's an income thing, but I would love to see it more inclusive.
Yeah.
That's what I want. I mean, because I know there's benefits to it. But I know it's a very much economic driver, because buying an organic tomato is a lot more than a non-organic tomato. But the flavor is two totally different experiences.
We are not quite done with our interview with Dr. Conyers, but we're going to take one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. We're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
One thing that you mentioned earlier that is really important to us on this show is sort of expounding what the South means. Because, like you said, people do have this sort of outside of the South, and sometimes even in the South, this one idea of what Southern food is. And it's so much more than that. And I read one of your hopes with being on Nourish is showing what makes the South special and unique. And in your mind, what is that?
What makes the South unique and special?
Mm-hmm.
For me, the South has a, even though no matter how divided the South was, in terms of food, like, people will cross over. Things could be very racist or segregation wise, but, like, you will find instances where food would bring people together. I think that's something I think is unique about the South. Well, food brings people together everywhere, but the South with its dark history of slavery, food has the ability to bring people together to have a conversation. And hopefully those conversations will help to make the South better, make it more one unit, help people understand people's differences as also their similarities. I think the South is, I don't know. I mean, no matter what is bad about the South, in some people's mind, I love it. I love the good and bad of the South. It's one of those things that's really hard to describe, though. And I guess you would say, like, the rural, I grew up in a rural area, and the rural area is a lot different from the city area. And I love both.
Do you get to go back home often?
I try to go home about four times a year. I went home four times this past year, and I think I saw my parents probably 6 or 7 times, so could they came out here. So that's, I go home because my family is there, and no matter where I go in life, like, family is important. And I think that's one of the things I learned about growing up in the South, like, family is everything.
Do you have any projects coming up, anything food wise or rocket science wise that you're excited about?
Actually, I'm excited. I mean, I haven't really talked a lot about it publicly, but I want to So there, I did an episode on grits for Nourish, but I have a grits mill, and I want to take this grits mill and bring it back into operation so people in my community could see what the grits mill meant, especially to, I will say to the Black, I mean, to me, I want to hear the Black families talk about how they survived with using the grits mill, the significance of it to the community, how they shared and worked together. And so I'm working on trying to bring a grits mill back to life that I have, a Stoneburg grits mill, because I think it's so many stories in history to be documented behind that. And I think those are where my next projects really lies, is taking time to really document and preserve those stories from experts. Because people may say Howard Conyers is an expert, but the people who are really experts in my mind are the people like my father, my mother, my aunts and uncles, who truly live this thing we treat so special. I'm just a mouthpiece, and I'm kind of an ambassador, and I'm a cheerleader, and I carry it forward. I'm a guardian keeper, but I want to take the time to really preserve the experts' opinions and knowledge base and people in my community. That's important. And we have the technology to do it. So that's kind of what I'm working on.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Is New Orleans home now, or do you still think of the Carolinas?
The Carolinas will always be home, but I'm slowly realizing I'm in New Orleans. I mean, like I love South Carolina, and I can never take that for granted. I mean, it has a special place in my heart, but New Orleans it's starting to get, they won't say it will be equal, but it's definitely rising for me, because the things I see in New Orleans, I can't see anyplace else in the country. And the food experiences I've been a part of, I don't think I've been able to do that anywhere else in the country. Even if it was in a place like New York, New Orleans has something special. And Louisiana has something special. I think people get caught up on New Orleans, but I think people need to also look at like areas like Opelousas. And there's so much fascinating culture in areas like Opelousas or Eunice, Louisiana. There are small towns, but I think people are missing the boat. They always focus on New Orleans.
You were talking earlier about equity and getting poor segments and Black segments of the community more of an opportunity to enjoy these foods that cost a little bit more, or that not everyone has access to due to transportation issues, things like that. Could you speak a little bit about what you think New Orleans could do better?
I think there's an education that needs to occur in that whole space. I think it's an education. You have to educate people on why this food is better, because people will spend money on whatever they seem valuable if they have it. But I think there's a lack of education on why it's better. And so that may be an opportunity to do it better. I think, sometimes the access to it, the location of it is, New Orleans is not a big place, but I can't expect a family who's struggling with transportation, they better only come to the farmer's market for a few things, and they can't get everything they need on their grocery list. That's kind of tough.
Yeah.
So those are kind of my thoughts on it.
Is there anything that we haven't asked you or that you would like to talk about before we wrap up here?
I just like, if people ever want to get in contact with me, I mean, I have a website, howardconyers.com. I do come speak. I do go speak and share my knowledge of food, science, engineering to different audiences, because I think it's important to, like, people don't notice about me. I really want to help inspire the next generation that they could do anything they want to do. And I want to make sure people from not only urban areas have inspiration, but I want people from rural areas to have inspiration. And if they could see it through my work, that's even better. And so I offer myself up to society of like, I try to give back where I can, where it makes sense.
That's great. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
No, that's no problem. I don't know if y'all knew I was one of the Southerners of the Year for this year.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
congratulations.
I got named one of the Southern Living Southerners of the Year.
Aww.
Thanks.
Nice. That's wonderful.
Whatever that means.
It might be that cow focus thing. Put you over the edge.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about the cow thing. I don't know. I'm kind of crazy for that, for that whole cow thing. But I enjoyed it. It was a pleasure to cook the whole cow. It was a pleasure to do this podcast interview. And thank you for taking time to want to talk to Howard Conyers. I mean,
it was a delight.
Yes, thank you so much.
And back to the present. Oh, thank you. Thank you again so much to Howard. And yes, again, if you want to learn more about his work or possibly get him to come on out and teach your classroom or organization or whatever about barbecue science, just go to howardconyers.com. That's howardconyers.com. What a pleasure. It's always so amazing to get to talk to other people who are just as nerdy about the science bits as I am. That's our episode for today. If you would like to get in touch with us, you can do that thing. We are available in a number of ways. You can email us at hello@saverpod.com, or you can find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.